Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and this is then-Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg answering a question from then-Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joe Biden at a confirmation hearing in 1993.
May I leave you, Mr. Chairman?
I mean, if you'd like to answer it more fully, I'm anxious to.
Just two thoughts that you can think about in between now and our next round, but but one of them was prompted by Senator Mosley Braun when she reminded us that the spirit of liberty must lie in the hearts of the women and men of this country. It would be really easy, wouldn't it, to appoint platonic guardians who would rule wisely for all of us, but then we wouldn't have a democracy, would we? We cherish living in a democracy. And we also know that this Constitution did not create a tricameral system. Judges must be mindful of what their place is in this system and must always remember that we live in a democracy that can be destroyed if judges take it upon themselves to rule as platonic guardians.
For more on how Ruth Bader Ginsburg conducted herself as a Supreme Court justice and how she was as a person, we're joined by someone who had an up-close view. David Franklin is a professor at DePaul College of Law in Chicago, where he teaches constitutional law, administrative law, and conflict of laws. He was also Solicitor General of Illinois, basically the state's top appellate lawyer, from 2016 to 2019. But most on point for our conversation today, he was a law clerk to Justice Ginsburg in 1999 and 2000. David Franklin, let me first offer my condolences and say welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Brian, and good morning to you and your listeners.
Good morning. So can you recall for us the first time you met Justice Ginsburg or heard from her? I think, you know, those of us who have never been Supreme Court clerks, it's a bit mysterious how that process works.
Sure. The first time I met her was in my clerkship interview with her, which happened to be on my 30th birthday. I was a little bit older, I suppose, than most of the young people who apply for clerkships, having taken some time after college and so forth. But that was it. That was the first time that we'd ever met. I had sent in my resume and my application and my references and so forth. And I guess it piqued her interest and she wanted to meet me. So we had a nice conversation for about half an hour and that was that.
What was your first impression of her?
Well, I was told or maybe warned ahead of time by many people that I spoke to who had either clerked for her or knew her in some capacity, that she was a very soft-spoken, quiet, rather retiring person. You could hear a little bit of it in the clip that you played just before I came on. She had a way sometimes of pausing for long periods of time right in the middle of a sentence. And so all of my people told me, just don't fill the space. Just wait it out. Let the pause go through, which is, I'm sure, would be dead air on radio.
Believe it or not, that is one of the things they tell us is let people fill their own silences.
You
didn't
want
to interrupt the justice.
but in her own way, she was also very warm and easy to talk to. She didn't really want to talk about deep legal questions on that occasion. You know, she had sort of heard from my recommenders and so forth. And I think at that point, in a job interview, often the potential boss just wants to make sure that you don't have three heads and, you know, you're a person that they could get along with in the office. And so we made small talk and it was very pleasant.
That's interesting because I've heard one of the stories I've seen is that she was not one to make small talk very much. What was it like day to day working for her?
So once I was working for her, I think there wasn't very much small talk. She was all business in that sense. She was a relatively formal person, not the kind of boss who would stop by your desk or the water cooler and shoot the breeze. She liked to communicate through written memoranda or often through voicemail. I would often get voice messages from her that were time-stamped, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning, because she used to come into the office maybe around 11 or noon, and then work through the afternoon, and then make sure that she got home in time for one of the amazing home-cooked dinners that her husband Marty prepared. And then she would work reading briefs and constructing arguments and drafting opinions deep into the night. And she would often leave a message saying, "David, paragraph 2 on page 17, the arguments are in the wrong order." You know, something very, very specific. She was very detail-oriented and very thorough.
Yeah. You know, she famously, I mean, there have been also stories that, you know, a Super Bowl parade from the Washington football team was once marching past the Supreme Court, and she asked another clerk, this is something I read online, you know, what all the ruckus was, and he said the Super Bowl, and her response was reportedly, "What's the Super Bowl?" Just not one for...
That sounds apocryphal.
It does. Okay.
To me, but
okay.
I don't think she was a big sports fan, that's for sure. But her sport was called opera.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you about. I'm glad you mentioned that. I've heard many clerks got to go to the opera, or maybe, depending on one's perspective, had to go to the opera with her. Were you one of
I
the lucky?
I think I was in the second category.
Okay.
Yes.
What did you see?
It was her one little bit of forced cultural education, you could say. She had the four of us clerks who were working for her go with her, I believe, to the Kennedy Center, and we saw Tosca, which is, of course, one of the great operas, and I must say it was lost on me.
But she did have a sense of humor, right? It could be, I'm not sure what word to use here, sly or subtle or dry at times?
Oh, yes. She often liked to sort of kibitz with you if you happen to be sitting next to her at an event or a reception, just kind of give her views on the goings on. She was very funny, actually. It's just that the world didn't get to see that very often. And I think she took her public role very seriously. So, you know, it one of the wonderful things about her life was her many decades of marriage to Marty Ginsburg, which is dramatized in a feature film that came out recently. And he was hilarious and gregarious and often slightly outrageous and the life of the party. And that sort of allowed her to hang back a little bit more. And just they complemented each other really beautifully.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are speaking with David Franklin, who's a law professor at DePaul College of Law in Chicago and was a clerk to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1999 and 2000. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So, David, what were some of the standout cases during your time working for Justice Ginsburg?
We had a lot of them. We had the first so-called partial birth abortion case. We had a case about whether the FDA could regulate cigarettes. We had several important First Amendment cases. I'm probably forgetting some, but it was a jam-packed year. There wasn't any one absolute blockbuster case, but we had many, many important ones.
I would say you missed Bush versus Gore by one term, I think, right?
I missed Bush versus Gore by about 6 months, and I'm very glad I did.
Well, how would you describe her judicial philosophy, right? We have these competing schools out there. You hear about originalist or textualist is another flavor of that. And then you have the active constitution. Did she subscribe to a particular mode of constitutional interpretation, or did she have a different approach?
I think she had a much more pragmatic case-by-case approach. I don't think she was very interested in signing on to large theories. She obviously had her special interests. You know, if she had never been on the Supreme Court, she would still be regarded as the single most important advocate in our justice system for women's equality because of all the things that she did before she became a judge. So obviously that issue was near and dear to her heart. But even there, I think there's an insight to be gained about how she thought about these sorts of things, because she was very outspoken about the fact that Roe versus Wade, for example, was, in her view, correctly decided. She was a passionate believer in reproductive rights as a protected right under the Constitution, but she didn't think that it needed to be protected in sort of broad, abstract, gauzy, freedom-based terms. She saw it as a much more practical issue about the ability of women to participate in equal terms, on equal terms, in American society and in our economy. And so for her, it was a straightforward, practical issue of gender equality. So she viewed things in a very practical way, and she was very interested, Brian, in the facts of each case. She cared about how the case had been tried in the trial court, what the procedural history of the case was, what the other judges who had already passed on the case had said about it, and tended to shy away from large pronouncements.
You know, I think Justice Ginsburg, popularly at least, is as well known for her dissents as for her majority opinions. I mean, a lot of the pop culture ephemera, which I want to get to that in a minute, but you know, there's I dissent pins with her likeness on it. I wonder, from your perspective, is it a loss that her time on the court was an era of conservative ascendancy, conservative majorities?
Well, I certainly think so, because the fact that she was in dissent meant that she wasn't able to move the law in the direction that she favored, which also happens to be the one that I favor. So, you know, it's the problem in those cases was that the majority was wrong.
Did you ever get the sense that she felt she was, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
I was just saying, did you ever get the sense that she felt she was out of time? Like, boy, wouldn't it have been great to be on the Warren Court or something like that? Or is that just not sort of fanciful thinking that she engaged in?
That wasn't her way. She was a person, and she spoke about this many times herself. She was a person who just put her head down and did the work. And she was not one for resentment or regret or looking backward. So she always played the cards that she was dealt. You know, when she was in law school and Marty became ill with cancer just at the time they had their first child, and she needed to not only study for herself, but basically take notes for Marty because he couldn't physically go to class. So she was basically doing law school for two while being a mother of a young child. She just did it. You know, when she graduated law school and found that there were barriers placed in her way just because she was a woman, even though she had finished at or near the top of her class, she just persisted, to use the popular phrase, I guess, and broke through those barriers in her own way, which was slowly, carefully, step by step. When I arrived at the court as her law clerk, it was within the first week that I was there that she got her first cancer diagnosis with colorectal cancer. And that was during the summer. And she was determined to be on the bench that first Monday in October, ready to go. And she was. She was just an incredibly determined, resolute person.
You clerk for Justice Ginsburg years before the notorious RBG took off as a pop cultural phenomenon. Can you cast your memory back to 1999 and someone says to you, your boss is going to be portrayed on Saturday Night Live, available as a stuffed doll, and people will be getting tattoos of her? How does 1999 David Franklin respond to that?
I would have giggled. I mean, you know, she's, if you knew her, she's the last person in the world that you would ever think would become that kind of icon, because she was so shy and so retiring and also really fundamentally conservative with a small C in her approach to the law and in some ways to life. I mean, obviously she had a very liberal worldview in terms of the rights that she thought all people should enjoy. But the way that she went about pursuing that was never radical, and she never sought attention for herself. But, you know, I think her advent as a pop culture icon has several causes. Part of it was that her husband, Marty, died, and she had a decision to make about sort of how to move on from that. And I think she decided consciously, I never spoke with her about this, but my sense was that she decided consciously to step forward, to make more public appearances, to make more public statements, some of which were frankly somewhat controversial for a sitting Supreme Court justice. And then when Justice John Paul Stevens retired, which made her the senior liberal justice on the court, she was sort of placed in the role of speaking for that wing of the court more forcefully, and she embraced it. And then it just so happened that some young women were inspired by her and decided to meme her in that way. And I think she was tickled by it. I think she really kind of secretly enjoyed all of the attention.
Yeah. Last question. And this has just got to be a quick answer because we've got less than a minute left. But I came across an online bobblehead store accepting pre-orders for Justice Ginsburg doll. It's available two versions, smiling and serious. I mean, you knew her in a way her legions of admirers never could. So my question to you, which is the definitive Ginsburg, smiling or serious?
Smiling.
David Franklin was a clerk to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg from 1999 to 2000. He's also a law professor at DePaul College of Law in Chicago. He was also Solicitor General of Illinois from 2016 to 2019. David Franklin, thank you so much for sharing your memories with us here on the 21st. And again, my condolences.
Thanks, Brian. Take care.
More to come on Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg after a short break. You are listening to the 21st. Stay with us.